everyone. Welcome to Talk Nerdy. It is Monday, January 11th, 2016, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. It is the first episode of the new year. Thank you guys so much. This has been a really great last year. I think I actually started in 2014. So gosh, we've been on the air now for over a year. That is insane. Thank you guys for sticking with me through my hiatus over the break. It's been 2 weeks. I missed you a whole lot, but I am back now. And before we start the show, I want to, as always, give a shout out to those of you who help Talk Nerdy stay on the air. Remember, Talk Nerdy is 100% free to download. You can find it on iTunes. You can find it on, you know, Stitcher, Podcatcher. I think that's a thing. any place where the RSS feed is picked up. And yeah, you can download it free anytime. And the reason for that is because a handful of amazing people like you support the show in the ways that you can. So first through the PayPal portal, which you can find by visiting my website, carasantamaria.com. I would like to thank Amanda Munster for your recurring support. Amazing. Thank you so much, Amanda. I also want to thank, let's see, Rob Miller from Kent in the United Kingdom. And I want to thank Stephanie Williams from Corona, California for a really, really generous donation this week. Thank you so much, Stephanie. And over through the Patreon portal, which you can visit by going to patreon.com/talknerdy. I want to thank those of you who support on an episodic basis. I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Timothy Glover, Malcolm Waddy II, Gabriel Felipe, Jaramillo Gonzalez, Ken Pfeiffer, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you guys so very much. And remember, this is not the only way to support the show. You can rate and review on iTunes. You can spread the love around. Send me a tweet. Use the hashtag TalkNerdy. Tell your friends and family. All right, enough of that business. I'm really excited about this week's show. I sit down with a very interesting woman who had kind of a twisty, turny path through academia and then into the wonderful world of public health. So please welcome to the show, Noemi Sportish. Well, Noemi, thank you so much for sitting down with me in my apartment.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Still haven't moved out of. I'm always talking about moving out of my apartment into the new house, and it's like so slow. It's never going to happen. No, it'll happen at the end of this month. So we're back from hiatus. I took a 2 week hiatus. I kind of forgot to announce it this year. Last year, I like made a big deal out of it this year. And so I got all these tweets from people like, am I missing something? Like, why isn't there a new episode? And I'm like, oh, I always take hiatus. Like, always. I've done it 1 year before because the podcast isn't that old yet. But we are back, and I am excited to be chatting with you because we met in an odd kind of way.
Yeah.
So I guess right now I'm looking at the thing. We are recording this on Saturday, January 9th. It'll go live on Monday, the 11th. We met in Pavilions, which is a grocery store here on the West Coast. Do you know if Pavilions is in other parts? Because you're from the East Coast.
Yeah, I don't even think it's in Northern California, actually.
Oh, really? It's just a SoCal grocery
store? Yeah, okay. Yeah. So I live on the East Coast now, and we definitely don't have it
there. Yeah, and we didn't have it in Texas for sure. Like, out here, we have a grocery chain called Ralph's, which is basically Kroger. It's like the same brand. So I don't know why it has a different name out here.
Yeah.
It's very strange. But Pavilions, I'm not sure. Oh, Pavilions is Vons. Yeah, but I also think that's a California chain.
Or yeah, and it's different in Northern California. I think it's Safeway.
Yeah, it's so Safeway weird.
Maybe that's the equivalent of Ralph's, actually. I'm not sure.
It's very hard to say. But anyway, that was a really important conversation we just had. Mm-hmm. No, so we met at Pavilions, and I was looking for ham because it was Christmas. Was it like Christmas Eve?
Yeah, I think it was.
That's so funny. Yeah. And you were like, oh my gosh, hey, it's weird that you, did you recognize me from my face or my voice? Was I like, I need ham? And you were like, I know that voice.
I actually recognize you from your face because you're the only woman on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. So I had looked you up at one point because I was like, this girl's awesome. And then I totally recognized you.
That's so weird, but also kind of fun and strange. Yeah. It's very rare for me. People are like, you're on TV, so you're famous and you make lots of money. And I'm like, none of those things are true. I am on TV and I work very, very hard to make this, you know, to get by. But definitely being in a public arena, sometimes you'll have a certain level of fame in a certain like niche. That's how I say it. I'm from the South, a niche group. But it is pretty rare for me still. I would say once when I was at the gym, somebody recognized me. It's maybe happened once or twice at the airport. Whenever it happens, of course, you're like, whoa, this is weird. So you gave me a little Christmas Eve bump. Yay. We were both in our pajamas, by
the
way.
Yeah, okay. Well, that makes me feel better. I was like, oh, God.
I'm in my pajamas. Like in leggings and Uggs. Like, I don't wear normal people clothes unless I'm on camera. I have, like, this rule where... see, you have a normal person job, which we'll get to. But it's like, when I'm on camera, I'm in full hair and makeup, and I'm wearing clothes. And granted, sometimes it's not, like, glamoury, like, on-set hair and makeup. It's, you know, because I'm reporting out in the field, so it's, like, normal people hair and makeup. But for me, it's very much a part of my job. Like, I have to put on makeup, I have to do my hair, and I have to put on clothes that are, like, acceptable for TV. No logos, no tight patterns, no white. There's all these rules for TV cameras. And so when I'm not on camera, I am dressed the way you see me now. My hair is, like, in a messy bun. I'm not wearing any makeup, and I'm in sweatpants and Uggs, like, every day because I'm super lazy. But also, I think everybody's in pajamas on Christmas Eve, right?
Yeah, probably.
Like the national uniform of Christmas Eve. So anyway, we met. I think we were, like, in the milk and cheese department.
Yeah, I think we were. Right, by the, I think I was picking up eggs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you were like, by the way, what did you guys do for Christmas dinner? Were you getting Christmas dinner food or just
What did we do for Christmas dinner? I think my mom has gotten really attached to doing a rack of lamb in the last bunch of years. And I'm trying to remember if that's what we did, because we did a couple of dinners related to the holidays this time. But I think it was a rack of lamb and then some roasted root vegetables with fennel.
Fancy sounding.
And my sister got really fancy, actually. My sister made a whole bunch of fancy wild rice stuff.
Oh, that's nice.
Cranberry tart.
And so you live in Mass, but your home, this is home for the holidays. Like, are you from here or just your family lives here?
No, I'm from here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I grew up in LA, which is actually pretty important for how I ended up doing what I'm doing now. So
let's actually talk about that. We don't have to talk about Christmas at dinner anymore. It's not that interesting. It's a little bit expired. We actually just threw out some Christmas food from the fridge. It's kind of gross. So I didn't say that out loud. So you grew up in LA. In LA proper, like in the city?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
Actually, close to 10 here? Minute walk from here.
Oh, that's so funny.
So I'm in the center of LA in Hancock Park, right by Melrose, like right by Pavilions, actually.
Yeah.
It's like right next to Pavilions.
Well, it would make sense if we met at the same grocery store. Because this is my hood. It's technically, I live in Hollywood, but it's kind of on the Hancock Park border. I won't be here much longer, so I don't mind giving away my whereabouts. And soon to be Los Feliz, which is why that makes sense now that you're like, oh yeah, that area is great. Like, you know, LA. So you grew up here, and then where did you go to school? Did you go to school here?
I did, actually. So it's kind of a funny story because I did not want to stay here. Mm-hmm. Like so many people, I think, that go to college in the U.S., they're all like, oh, I want to go really, really far away from where I grew up.
For sure.
But my parents were like, listen, we're checking off the box for UCLA, which is where I ended up going, because it's just, you know, part of the UC application and you're going to go see it. And I went to see it and I loved it. And then I ended up going there. So,
and at least it's like UCLA is, I mean, it's the West Side. It's a little different because I'm assuming you moved into like either a dorm or an apartment over there. Yeah, it's, you know, like it's a solid hour drive with traffic. So.
Yeah. It's funny that the proportions in LA make no sense whatsoever. Yeah. Like in any other city, you're like an hour drive is not the same city anymore.
Yeah.
But LA is just a weird animal.
Oh my God. It takes like an hour to go 5 miles. It's the well, maybe more like 10 miles to UCLA or 10 or 15. It's not that far.
Yeah.
And it takes forever.
Yeah, it does. That's maybe so you stupid. Can just bike around in Los Feliz now.
Yeah, like full, I'll have the full-on hipster experience. That'd be great. I'm not riding a bike. Come on.
Come on. I love bikes. What are you talking about?
I have an electric car. My job. It's like a bike.
That's pretty cool, actually. Yeah.
No, I know. I should ride a bike. I'm really bad at riding a bike. Even when I was a little kid, like I learned how to ride a bike. Like you have to, like rite of passage. And I just always sucked at it. Like I could never hop curbs. I was always like kind of wobbly and like falling. It's just not my thing. I'm
hopping
not
curbs is hard.
It is hard.
That was not something that came easily for me.
I can do it now.
Yeah, but I have like thick city tires on my bike, so that makes a big difference.
Do you ride like a mountain bike or like a speed? I don't even know what kinds of bikes there are out there. You don't ride like a beach cruiser, right? Because that's like what everybody around here rides are those stupid beach cruisers with the big
baskets on the front, but they're the big, weird, wide handlebars that seem hard to control.
Yeah, no, I don't have that. Okay. I have like, I have a public bike. It's, I think they were, they might be based out of San Francisco. They're okay. either San Francisco or Portland, and I always get it mixed up which one it is. But they're basically like a hybrid between like a bike that would actually get you someplace fast mm-hmm. and usefully. So there are seven gears on my bike and it's an internal hub, which means that I never have to maintain anything, which is really practical for me.
Yeah.
But and then it's an upright bike with a basket.
So oh, it does have a basket. Yeah, it is helpful.
Oh my God. I laugh at all the people who have to like carry their heavy packs on the back and I just like have my stuff in my basket and I'm like, this is wonderful. I'm enjoying life. It's so easy.
That's pretty smart. And so when you have multiple gears on a bicycle, I'm like, I have no idea what I'm talking about right now. When you have lots of gears on a bicycle, is it like a manual transmission of a car where you have to choose the gear you're in, or do they just go through them automatically?
For my bike and most bikes, mm-hmm. I actually don't know like what the proportion would be for bikes where that is automatically done for you, because I could imagine that being the case, but mm-hmm. it's manual. You choose it. So you're like, oh, this is way too hard. I'm gonna shift to an easier gear.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay. So it's kind of just based on how bad your legs hurt.
Okay. Or how fast you want to go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Because you want to kind of slow yourself down. Yes. Or if you're like a badass and you want to go fast. Yeah. I think I'm scared too. I have friends who ride bikes in the city. I have a good friend who Janet Varney, who does a Nerdist podcast called, what is it called? The JV Club. And she was a host on HuffPost Live back when I was a science, what was I there? Oh my God, I'm so fucking tired today.
Correspondent?
Yeah, that was actually my title.
Oh, really?
Good nice. Call. Yeah, because I was like, I wasn't an editor. What was I? Yes, I was like the science correspondent there. And she was a host on HuffPost Live, so we would interview a lot. And she got in a She actually lived in Los Feliz, and then the HuffPost offices were at the AOL offices in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, it's a bit of a trek. And she got in a brutal bike accident on the way to work one day and like had to have her jaw wired shut. And she was just like brutalized, and it scared the shit out of me. And I see it sometimes. And granted, you know, even if you are wearing a helmet or you're being as protective as you can, I think there are certain cities that are better bike cities than others. I think LA is trying. They're doing their part to try. We're starting to see more and more bike lanes and more signs that are like, share the road, bicyclists are, you know, not pedestrian. Because it's hard. You're sort of halfway between a pedestrian and a driver when you're on a bicycle, but you're way less protected.
Yeah, you could be taking those words out of my mouth. And actually, I'm like smirking over here, which nobody can hear. But if you could hear a smirk, you would hear me smirk. No, this is my job. Like, this is a core component of my job, is figuring out how to do these things and actually use the public health frame to talk about them, because mm-hmm. you're talking about people, right? You're talking about injuries. You're talking about quality of life, having the option to choose to bike, to choose to drive, to choose to walk, to choose to do those kinds of things safely. Yeah. And, you know, frankly, like comfortably also.
Yeah, definitely. To kind of have both the education to know the best way to protect yourself. Because it's not just, it's twofold, right? Because it's about, yes, when you ride a bike or you walk or you run, it's like a healthier endeavor than sitting on your ass in a car. But at the same time, it's not healthy if you're dead. Yeah, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's finding that balance between like doing something that's really good for you and really healthy, but it being safe enough and in your community to be able to do it. And of course, so we're getting there eventually. And I did mention that you're in Massachusetts with your job. You mm-hmm. live in Massachusetts, but you're from Southern California. So you studied at UCLA. Did you study public health?
No, I had no idea it was a possibility. I didn't even know what public health was at the time, actually. I studied cognitive science when okay. I was at UCLA, because I think it's kind of a catch-all major for people who don't really know what they want to do, but that are interested in science. And for me, I specialized in neuroscience, actually, cool. while I was there. So you could sort of like subspecialize into neuroscience or linguistics or computer science or mathematics. It was a really broad major, yeah. actually, but kind of focused on artificial intelligence and what got me into that, which is still what I do now, actually, is understanding why people make the choices that they make and sort of understanding human behavior. And now I'm sort of more on the nudge side of that. But I actually have been doing the same thing in lots of different forms since then.
That's really interesting. You know, it's funny because sometimes what ends up happening for people, I think, who are really passionate in their chosen field of study, or I should say their chosen applied field of work, is that they figure out how to get where they're going to be based on what's available. And what's available is not always the cleanest path. Like, mm-hmm. I had a friend of mine, Tegan Wall, on the podcast. She's one of the Nerd Brigade, and she actually just finished her PhD from Caltech. And she's interested in very similar, but sort of from a different angle. So a lot of people, when you think about cognitive science, right, it's sort of a hybridization of, like you said, neuroscience, psychology, mm-hmm. some computer science. So there's the AI component, but there's also the like sensation and perception component, decision making, all of that. So she actually studied economics, and that was sort of her way in, because economics is so heavily focused on making decisions that like maximize your options, making decisions that are like path of least resistance decisions. Like, we think of economics as being money, but it's not money. Like, there's economics in every aspect of life. And so she studied neuroscience and economics and sort of came to a similar research focused area. But now you are in a more applied side of it in public health. And she, I think, went into like the financial system. Which is another, you know, it's funny, but that's like a totally similar yet very different choice.
Yeah.
And I have other friends who studied cognitive science who now do wildly different things, but all still within the sciences. So you started in cognitive science. You did your undergrad in that at UCLA. And then how did the transition continue?
So I think like there was a pivotal class that I took, and it's probably a similar story for other people, but I took a class on the neuroscience of sleep and dreams.
Ooh,
such
fun.
A cool title, right?
Oh my gosh.
And it was a wonderful class and I loved it. And it's a class that I remember really well. And I got close with a professor because I was super interested in the topic area. And it was also my last year, so I think I was probably most mature during my time there. Sometimes I wish I could go back knowing what I know now, and I was like, oh, I'd do so much more. But
yeah, what a great class to take when you were a senior, because I bet you a lot of people, unless it was an upper level class, would probably try to take it. You know, it's a class that looks good in the course guide.
Yeah.
And so it's attractive. So you get younger people going towards it, and maybe they're not quite have the background to really get out of it what they could. Like, we had a class called Psych of Sexual Behavior that satisfied our health credit to you at my university. And you literally like watch videos of people having sex. Super fucking weird. And it was so funny too, because early in the semester, it would be like a hot young couple. And then like they would increasingly get like older and hairier. And you're like, oh God. But you know, that class was like full of freshmen, when it shouldn't have been, because we actually were talking about very difficult concepts and you needed a lot of psych background to fully understand it. But it was mostly people going like, they're fucking on camera.
Yeah.
Okay. But I wonder if this would have been a similar experience. Like, the younger kids maybe didn't get as much out of it.
What a cool maybe. Class. And I don't remember whether it was structured with prerequisites or not. But regardless, I developed a relationship with that professor, and I asked him I had to do a practicum or something like that. I forget what it was called exactly for my major. And so I asked him if I could do it in his lab, and it was a neuroscience lab where they studied sleep. And sleep and neurogenesis were the things that he was studying at the time. And so I ended up doing that with him, and then he gave me a job afterwards. And in a lot of ways is totally responsible. I think he's totally responsible for, you know, giving me, I think, the self-efficacy and the sense of sort of interest in science and, you know, these kinds of questions to continue on in different ways. So also probably made me look more credible. That's a nice job to start out with.
Yeah. And I think it's funny because you're right. It's an uncommon, non-traditional, yet very common path where in the undergrad level, a bright student will be fortunate enough to meet a great professor that they connect with, and then continue on kind of sowing the seeds that were sort of planted there. I myself took a year off in between my undergrad and my master's to work for a neuropsychologist who I did my undergrad thesis with. Like, the same thing. I took time. I worked in his lab. Oh my God, did it help me when I went on to do more education and switch gears again in the future, because I had like practical. It's one thing to just like be in school your whole life. I have a lot of friends who just finished their PhDs that are like drowning because they have to do like grown-up things now. And they're in their 30s and they're like, I don't know how to be alive. And so I think for me, taking time off in between degrees and doing like real people jobs was hugely helpful especially when I made the decision to drop out of my PhD program, you know, when you make the decision to finally say, okay, I'm done with academia, because everybody has to make that decision. Even PhD students oftentimes are like, no, I'll just get another postdoc. Like, they don't want to leave academia. And everybody ultimately does have to make the decision, like, am I going to go into the real world or am I going to stay in academia? And you, of course, went into the real world.
Yeah, I did. Although not immediately, actually. Yeah. I mean, so I went into the lab first. And actually, at that time, I mean, I was interested in the work that we were doing. But then I actually really wanted to work more with people. I wanted to do mm-hmm. things that I also that I think were just more tangible. I mean, when you work in certain kinds of labs, we worked with rats. So we were, okay.
So you weren't a human lab.
No.
I was going to say, even if you were working with people, they'd be unconscious the whole time. So.
Yeah, God, those hours are terrible, actually, if you work in a real sleep lab, because you work at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would love that, actually, but I could see it would be hard for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, that's not my thing. Yeah. Rats are nocturnal, so, you know.
Oh, that's, okay.
Yeah. And we had them in, like, little controlled sleeping environment areas so that they weren't affected by, you know, changes in daylight like
sure.
we are.
Yeah. I got, sorry, random aside, I got a Christmas present from a good friend of mine. She got me this little thing called, I'm going to put it on my screen so you can see it, but people at home, you can Google it. I think it's by a company called Dino Pop, and they're called, I could be wrong, so I'm going to adjust that if I, yeah. They're called Dino Pet, and it's by Biopop is the company, and it's basically dino flagellates, so bioluminescent photoplankton.
Oh, cool.
And it's like a little dinosaur-shaped container, and then the phytoplankton, you know, they glow, but they only do that at night mm-hmm. because they're circadian cycles are really sensitive. And so it's the best I was like so excited when I got this present, but you actually have to pay close attention. You have to like make sure it gets enough daylight during the day, and then you can't turn on the lights in it. So I'm always moving them from room to room so they can stay in the dark at night, because I don't want to disturb this, like, these stupid little like plankton sleep cycles. But it's important, right? Because I'm kind of nocturnal, so I'm always turning the lights on at like 3 a.m. and I'm like, I need to put them in the bathroom. Don't wake up my phytoplankton. But aren't they fun?
Yeah, guys, they're
this
really
is a
cool.
Great gift.
I'm already getting gift ideas.
I know,
this.
Right? It's so good. And it's totally affordable too.
Yeah,
fun. Yeah. Anyway, okay, that was like a huge aside. So you're working with the mice, but you're able, because they're nocturnal, to actually keep pseudo normal hours.
Yeah. I mean, I work 7 days a week, like so many people do who are running experiments. But yeah I work during the day, which was really nice.
And, you know, it's like some days you work like an hour or two because your experiment fails, or at least you were with live animals. I was working with cells. So it's like, oh, the fucking cells died. Like, what can you do? You know what I mean? So it's like some days are really short and some days you're like, it's going and I don't want to stop it. I want to just keep. And then you end up working like 24 hours straight.
I have a lot of friends who work with cells actually in Massachusetts. Yeah. And so they end up having those kinds of things. They're like, I'm really sorry, I can't do dinner because my culture worked. And so I still have to stay and work on my, work in my lab. So
it's exciting, but it's also like, shit. My experiment's going really well, which means I have to cancel everything I was going to do tonight. But so with mice though, I've done some live animal research too. I actually think that's a lot harder. I would oftentimes have to do the I did a lot of the culture dissection, so I would sacrifice the live animals to make the cell cultures, and that's a little different because it's like you're on a pretty rigid schedule because you have to be, because they were like timed pregnant, because I used fetal mice. But live animal labs are way less controlled. I mean, they're not less controlled, the experiments aren't technically less controlled, but like your angle has to be more on the fly, you know, because they're animals. They do what they gonna do.
Yeah, no, it's a lot. There are certain things that we would try to control, but yeah, it's definitely tricky, or it can be tricky.
Did you ever get bit?
No. So I didn't actually work with mice. I worked with rats.
That's worse.
No, they're better. Rats are so much better than mice.
You think so?
Yeah. The mice are they're such a pain. And if you drop them, you can never find them again.
You have to
hold them by the tail.
Yeah.
The time.
Mice are small. You have to pick them up by the tail because they're kind of like fragile. But they're pretty sweet. Granted, I was always working with pregnant mice, so they were like a little different.
Yeah.
You know, they're like nesting and they were really sweet. But I have friends who worked with rats and I got bit by a rat. I'm gonna get rat bite fever. And also, when you sacrifice anybody listening is like, holy shit, what are they talking about? But when you sacrifice mice, there's like a very specific way to do it, but it's pretty clean because they're smaller and it's a little less like aggro. I don't know, but I had friends who worked with rats and they had to use a fucking guillotine.
Yeah, sometimes people use guillotine. Yeah. I actually, luckily enough, did not have to do any of that because I just, because
you were studying behavior. Yeah. So they were alive the whole time, which is good.
Yeah. I looked at brains and like, you know, stained brain sections and things like that because we were actually studying the effects of sleep fragmentation on neurogenesis and the lack thereof.
So you did need to look at their brains.
Yeah.
But was somebody else in your lab responsible for
they were responsible for sacrificing them and sectioning the brains. And then I would actually go in and count the cells and do things like that and run the behavioral experiments.
So you were doing fluorescent microscopy or just standard light microscopy, just counting. Were they just stained or were they like under the fluorescent microscope?
Oh God. I think they were stained actually. Yeah. I think they were stained. I'm trying to remember. It's been a really long time.
I did some fluorescent microscopy when I was in a bird lab. I was in a bird lab for like a year. It was when I started my PhD, but then I dropped out. So I didn't spend much time in it. And it was the same thing, like a lot of counting cells. But in a fluorescent scope, it fucking sucks because you always have to move the slides because they'll get bleached out from the fluorescence. And so it's like they glow, but the longer the fluorescence is on them, the more that they start to dim and you'll damage the tissue. So it's like I remember my professor described it as ironing. It's like you can't leave the iron in one spot too long or it'll burn. But if you're always moving it, then it like gets the job done. And so it's like you're counting all day and all night, just so tired with your headphones.
Yeah.
But then you're also having to like move the slide. Oh my God. The light microscopy is easier.
The people who I know who listen to the most podcasts are scientists, bench scientists.
That's so true. Yeah. I hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. Like I think there are people listening literally right now who are like laughing their asses off. They're like, I am doing fluorescent microscopy as we speak. And I'm so frustrated. That is so funny. Okay. So you were looking at the brains. You were both looking at the behavior of the mice and then also the brains of the mice after you got all of your behavioral data. And you were trying to see if waking them up multiple times during the night, I'm assuming fragmented sleep, minimized or affected in any way their neurogenesis?
Yeah, it was a rather complicated study. So you really want us to be studying mice. Yeah.
I know, I said mice. Rats. Shit.
So we were trying to understand, or we were basically studying the link between sleep fragmentation, but in this case it sounds really brutal. 30 seconds of sleep at a time.
Oh, that's so sad. This sounds like those classic, was it like a yoked control? Do you remember those classic studies?
Yep.
Poor fucking mice.
I know. The yoked controls were basically like halfway study animals also because it's horrible. Anyway.
Yeah.
So we studied those effects on the like, you know, neurogenesis in the brain, and we focused on the dentate gyrus and the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at behavior and we used this test called the Barnes test, which is a classic test used with rats. And it's meant to test memory.
Okay.
And we tried to see, and we had these rats forever because, you know, have to wait for the new neurons to grow so that, you know, those would be the ones that might be responsible for forming the new memories. And so we had each rat probably for a period of like 6 weeks because they would go through their experimental phase and then they would go through their like resting phase and then they'd go through their testing phase and then we'd have to sacrifice them and look at their brains and whatnot. So it was actually a really long experiment. But that was essentially what we were looking at. And we were modeling things like obstructive sleep apnea and restless leg syndrome, where people basically are waking up all the time and never get a consistent night's rest.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I recently did this crazy live television event with National Geographic Channel and Mental Floss. It was Brain Surgery Live. And we were in Cleveland. It was crazy. And I was co-hosting it with Bryant Gumbel.
Mm.
I don't know why that was hard to remember. Shouldn't have been. And Raul Jandial. And the patient had pretty severe Parkinson's disease. And that was like a very probably top line complaint of his. Like I did a lot of pre-interviews with him before the brain surgery. Like why do you, it was one of those like deep brain stimulation surgeries where they implant a pack so that you can stimulate your brain to help ease some of the symptoms of Parkinson's. Doesn't cure Parkinson's, obviously, but it can help like quality of life issues. And when I was asking him, like, what do you want? What do you want to get out of this? I want to be able to eat a meal without like making a scene at the restaurant because, you know, his hands were shaking all over the place and the tremors were really bad. But it was like, I want to fucking sleep through the night.
Yeah.
Like, I think many people with Parkinson's experience that because the drugs they take actually make their tremors worse. Mm-hmm. But then if they don't take their drugs, then they get that like locked in kind of feeling where it's just like deep cramping, deep intense pain. Like you just can't get comfortable. So you've got that. You said you've got people with restless legs, which in some ways is, I don't think it's really similar to Parkinson's, but it's you take similar drugs, I think, at the beginning of restless legs treatment.
That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Like I think people start with beta blockers, but then they often end up taking like L-Dopa for restless legs because it's a movement disorder where you just fucking kick.
Yeah, it kind of makes sense.
I actually dated a guy with restless legs, which is the craziest.
Did it fragment your sleep?
It did. Yeah. We weren't, luckily we didn't live together because that would have been really hard. We were in college, but his, and I remember I was one of the, you know, I'm a skeptic, like we're skeptics. Yeah. And you're like, restless legs are a real thing. You know what I mean? You'd see this. And that was always the butt of every joke when that first restless legs drug came out and you would see the commercials for it. And like every comedian would do a bit about like, they're making up diseases so they can push their pharmaceuticals on us. And I was like, no, legit. I know. A guy who has it, it's fucking horrible. Like he just was always in pain and he would have these like severe like kicks in the middle of like a horse, and it would like wake him up in the middle of the night every like multiple times through the night. How the fuck do you, sorry, I've been saying fuck a lot this week. I apologize. You haven't cursed
2016.
Yet. I know. The year of the fuck. You're so good.
East Coast.
yeah, right? That doesn't make any sense. I love it. Texan here. Howdy, y'all. Bless your heart. But yeah, it's really severe. And then what was the other thing that you were saying you were modeling?
Obstructive sleep apnea, which is probably the most common one. Not central, which would be where your brain literally tells you to stop breathing, but the one where your throat closes in on you.
Oh, I see. So that's kind of like people who snore so bad that can be a...
Shakes the walls.
Yeah.
Yep.
Ugh.
Yeah. They actually wake themselves up. It's really sad.
Oh, that is sad. Yeah. And so those things are often studied probably in the lab with people, and you were modeling... You weren't modeling the disease state, but you were modeling the outcome of the disease state.
Where we were trying to.
With the rats. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Did you find anything cool while you were there?
Yeah. I mean, so I think what we found, so it did actually suppress the neurogenesis, actually, or reduced it, I should say.
Yeah.
It didn't suppress it entirely, reduced it.
That would be bad if you suppressed it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then they would like not be able to really make it.
Yeah, I don't know how that would play out, actually.
Be like 51st date. That'd be sad.
Yeah. Or memento.
Yeah, or memento, exactly. Just from lack of sleep. Mm-hmm. Oof, that would be rough. That does happen, but it's usually because of like pretty traumatic brain injury.
Yeah. 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 Yeah, no, so we found that, and then we also found that it did affect the behavior, actually. So what happened, and we hypothesized that it was basically that it increased erratic behavior. So this is, none of this should be surprising if you've sort of experienced shitty sleep before. I just said a bad word.
Yes.
Hey.
Awesome.
yeah, no, so if you've slept really badly before, and then, you know, you just kind of like a little more anxious, and you're making scatterbrained decisions. Mm-hmm. But it's actually, what's interesting about it is it's not the next day. You know, they're fragmented for 2 weeks, I think, if I remember right. And then they had 2 weeks of rest because we wanted 3 weeks to be the midpoint of their two-week fragmentation, which was the growth of the new neurons. And then they'd go through 1 week of testing. Yeah. So
you're looking like 5 weeks down the line, their brains are heavily affected.
Yeah. And so then they had this erratic behavior, actually. So, you know, rats will develop strategies for trying to find, essentially they have a little hiding place in the Barnes maze, and you expose them on this open disc. Mm-hmm. And they have to find the little like cubicle to hide in. And, you know, they can basically learn where that is. But the rats that had been sleep fragmented, specifically not the yoked controls, just sort of like randomly went around the entire circle, like erratically in a sort of frightened way, which, you know, you can't blame them totally for that.
Yeah.
But they did that much longer than the other rats did. So that was another thing that we found. So they sort of had less ability to make rational decisions, I guess you could say, something along those lines.
Yeah. And probably, I mean, it's hard to hypothesize something like the emotional state of an animal, but definitely you could see some parallels there. Like, it's one thing talking about people who have really fragmented sleep being unable to think very clearly and their problem solving strategies being affected, right? So like not able to be as effective at their jobs, for example, but definitely just being grumpier, being more short fused and confused, really, you know, which I think is has a strong emotional a component to it, not just a cognitive one. I don't think you can really separate cognition from emotion personally, but it's complicated.
Yeah,
I
do say that.
It's true. But so this is, it's so funny. We're like halfway through the podcast already and I'm still talking to you about like your research when you were an undergrad. I'm like, tell me more. But I want to know about what you're doing now. So, but before we get there, because we got a little teaser with the bicycles. What was that bridge between taking the time after your undergrad and working basically full time, I'm assuming as a lab technician at this UCLA sleep lab and ending up on the East Coast working in public health in like community capacity?
Yeah. So I think a lot of people that I talk to these days have winding journeys, and mine was certainly no exception. But after the neuroscience lab, I was sort of like, all right, I want to work with people, but I'm still really interested in health. And these are things that I'm interested in. And there's a lot of doctors in my family. So I sort of segued into doing a post-baccalaureate program to prepare medicine, because weirdly enough, cognitive science doesn't have the prerequisites at UCLA to apply to medical school. So because I thought I wanted to do that. So I did that for a year. And
so
I took
you had to get like your organic chemistry and some of those classes.
Which I loved, by the way. Organic chemistry is super fun.
Yeah, that's weird. No, I want to promote that. Yes, OCHEM is awesome. Yay, OCHEM. No, it's true. Some people really take to it better than others. But yeah, it is, for many people, considered like the weed out class.
I know.
Like the hardest class they have to take in undergrad if they're going to go on to do medicine or advanced like physics, chemistry, biology. A lot of people have to take that class.
Yeah, I know. I loved it though. I still sometimes will draw molecules. I'm like, can I remember what that looks like?
That's awesome.
And how, what would be the most reactive part of this molecule if I were trying to think about it now?
Speaking of, I keep interjecting, but that's really what a long podcast is about. My friend Derek Muller, you probably know him as Veritasium on YouTube, but he invented, I guess is a strong word, but yeah, invented makes sense. These things called snatoms, and there was a Kickstarter that closed, but I think he still has an Indiegogo going, and I definitely recommend checking them out because it's a new way to model molecules that use these rotating magnets so that the and ball method is out the window because the sticks don't really represent bonds well. So they're really fun, and he even has like an upgrade with double bonds that are like little coily things.
Why are there
not more pictures? That makes me sad. Anyway, you should definitely, anybody who's interested, check out Snatoms online. They're very, very cool. And oh, here we go. So you can see kind of his.
Yeah, oh, that's adorable.
And yeah, so you can model molecules in a much more realistic way, like what they probably actually do look like instead of the old stick and ball method, which is not quite up to date with how we understand molecules to bond. Anyway, so now that you're all grown up, and even though you're not an OCHEM anymore, we could get you a Snatoms pack and then you could have fun with molecules at home.
Yeah. And then I can start putting, you know, location appropriate molecules in different places in my house.
Yes.
Caffeine in the kitchen.
That'd be awesome.
Urea in the bathroom.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
Yeah. So I did that. And then, you know, I was feeling a bit rebellious against the medical school track that I had chosen.
Sure.
And it takes a full year to apply. And so I had to decide what I was going to do during my sort of like gap year while I was applying. And I really wanted to actually go to Mexico and work on women's health. And so I found a job there in public health, actually, which I actually am ashamed in a way, I guess, to say that I still didn't know what it was really while I was working there, because it's just such an immensely broad field. And it suffers from one of those things that I think a lot of things suffer from, which is, you know, it's so obvious that you can't imagine that the scope is so large, because it's really just about the health of the public. And that is so multifaceted that, you know, you get entrenched in your little specific discipline and you kind of forget that that's really what it's about. But
and it probably never really developed. When we think of public health, it developed organically top down, not bottom up. So it wasn't like, or no, the other way around. It developed bottom up, not top down. So instead of saying, we shall create a field called public health and help everybody who has health issues, it was more just like in local communities, there were issues, and then people, nurses might come in or epidemiologists might come in. And so it's all woven together to be this big tapestry of a field. SciComm, I think, in a lot of ways is like that. SciComm, though, I think we've gotten good about branding. Ooh, science communication, it's so new and sexy, but it's not. Like, people have been doing science communication for ages, but it never was a real field until only maybe a decade or two ago. You know, there were the Sagans out there and the people who, like, I think were the trailblazers, and probably very similarly in public health, except that goes back hundreds of years, maybe even thousands. You know, if you really looked at the history of it,
probably
there were always people there to try and help the community, you know, help with like water cleanliness issues, or even early doctors were probably public health officials because they wore so many hats.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it would be interesting to know a little bit more about the history of public mm-hmm. health, actually. But it, certainly as a broader field as it exists today, it started with Jon Snow. In,
oh, interesting.
What was it? It was 18-something.
In England, right?
Yeah, in England.
It's so weird that you mention him. I interviewed what's-his-name from Game of Thrones for Wired at Comic-Con like 3 years ago.
So Jon Snow, but not Jon Snow in real life, but Jon Snow on TV.
Yes. So the guy who plays Jon Snow on TV. Why do I not know his name? Kit Harington.
Yes.
So I interviewed him, and I had read somewhere online. It was like one of these press junket things where you have like 5 minutes in between each interview, and then you're like Googling them like really fast to try and figure out something interesting to ask them about. And I saw online somewhere that he really wanted to be, when he was growing up, he wanted to become like an investigator or like a public how did he word it? It was like he wanted to be a war correspondent or something like that. And this is so funny because I think I'm going way off topic here, but his hero was a British, maybe it was the British war correspondent named Jon Snow. Let me see. British war correspondent. Watch, this is going to not make any sense. I'm going to have to edit it out. But in the meantime, here we go. And I'm wondering if he's the same. No, can't be him. The same Jon Snow, but he's not. There's two British Jon Snows. One of them was really... Anyway, okay. Yeah. So
one of them was probably in a pre-photographic era.
That's true. And also Jon Snow is probably a very common name. But interestingly, the guy who plays Jon Snow on TV wanted to, before he ever got cast in that role, wanted to work in a totally different capacity. And his hero was also a British dude named Jon Snow. But what you're saying is that modern public health started with also another Brit named Jon Snow.
Yeah.
How long ago? I'm going to look it up.
Beginning of the 19th century sometime. It could have been mid-19th century, actually. I think he passed away in like 1858, though. So it couldn't have been that far in the mid-19th century. But yeah. So regardless.
The first epidemiologist.
Yeah. It's actually the first thing you learn on your first day of public health school.
Nice.
Yeah. It was Jon Snow. Let's talk about it. And so basically what he did was that he actually tracked the responsible water spout for a cholera epidemic in London by actually mapping people's cases.
Oh.
And then he basically turned off that spout and that cholera epidemic went away. And that was like he was basically doing urban planning in a way, and he was doing public health. And those two fields actually sort of started together and then separated, where they were hugely successful at infectious disease eradication. I mean, there used to be like horses dying in the street in New York City in the beginning of the century. And people have no idea now. You know, we really don't think of cities as being that dirty. I mean, some cities are really dirty, but Los Angeles is relatively clean. You know, we certainly don't see any dead horses lying around.
For sure. And I mean, used to be that a lot of major cities didn't have like sanitation at all. People would throw their waste out the windows just into the street, which is disgusting.
Yeah.
I remember reading about Jon Snow, didn't remember his name at all because of, and I've mentioned this multiple times on the podcast, Dan Fagan's wonderful book, Tom's River, which won the Pulitzer last year. And it's all about a small town in New Jersey called Tom's River, where there was a factory and people were getting very, very sick. And it's about the epidemiological drama of trying to link cancer with environmental exposure, which is incredibly difficult to do. But he gives you a really good kind of history lesson in epidemiology. And so I remember the cholera story. I didn't remember the dude's name.
Yeah.
But he does a really good primer, actually, I think, on epidemiology and public health. So we often think of public health as being epidemiology, but it's a lot more than that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, epidemiology is the statistical method used to try to understand what the risk factors are for diseases on a population level. And also to track disease on a population level. But actually, there's a lot of other parts of public health that have to do with interventions, that have to do with understanding or sort of implementing different policies and programs. I mean, we talk about the different levels of change. So you can do educational change, you can do policy change, you can do change in, you know, street infrastructure, which is something we'll be talking about.
City planning.
City planning. And those things are all things that are actually, you know, going to change behavior in a completely different way. So education is actually the first thing that most people jump to, but actually will do very little for the people for in terms of separating or the people who are suffering the most, I guess, or the people who are need the most help and the people who are doing just fine. So if you put out like health food advice, the people who are rich and eating well already will be like, oh yes, like I should be doing that thing. And then the people who already don't have access to healthy foods, you know,
they're like, thanks for reminding me to go to Whole Foods.
Yeah, it's not going to help them. Or like, you know, where those sources are posted, that that where that education is dispersed to. I mean, it's just a really kind of, it's tricky. The education part is tricky. People will always say, well, if people know, then they can do it. But there are limitations to that, you know?
For sure. It's almost like change needs to be affected in a way that can help people who already have habits or already have specific lifestyle, sometimes choices, sometimes not choices. Changes in the at the community level where it's like, if I would do this anyway, because that's the choice that's right in front of my face. Like, as opposed to just like, let's be meta about it and talk about why this would be so great. It's like, oh, don't eat McDonald's. It's like, well, fuck you. McDonald's is the only food option I have. At least I'm eating and I can afford to put food on the table. Yeah. You know, and that's like a real difficult decision. And so basically when we think of epidemiologists, they're like the scientists that you see in movies like Outbreak and in movies like, what was the more recent one with, what's her name? Oh God, this is what happens.
I have no idea.
We always make fun of her on SGU cause she's like the worst. And she Goop. She has the health.
It's not Gwyneth Paltrow, is it?
Gwyneth Paltrow. Yeah, she's in it. She dies like in the very beginning. What movie the fuck? What the fuck movie am I thinking of?
I have no idea. I'm happy to report I have no knowledge of the recent motions of Gwyneth Paltrow.
She's only in it for like a minute. This is so funny because everybody listening to the podcast right now is just like yelling the name of this movie. It was like, I don't know, like 4 or 5 years ago. And it was like Outbreak, but not Outbreak. Contagion.
Oh, that was it. Yeah. It had an all-star cast.
Yeah.
Right?
It was really good too. It was like that standard, you know, you learned all about like patient zero. She was patient zero, I think.
Oh,
bitch. She died really early. So you see movies like that, like Contagion, the epidemiologists are like front center. It's like, oh, they're at the CDC and they're sitting at the big table and they're talking to the president about what they need to do and how are we going to develop a vaccine. And, you know, it's very sexy because it's when there's like an infectious disease outbreak that we're trying to contain. But then there are so many people that work in public health that you never hear about, you don't know anything about, who are kind of behind the scenes. I'm assuming in your role, you are one of these soldiers who kind of works to affect change every day. Not just when there's a big scary disease that outbreaks so that people can lead healthier lives. Because it's not always about getting swine flu. It's about keeping diabetes at bay. It's about helping to prevent childhood obesity, things like that, that actually have a greater effect on public health.
Yeah, at this point, I mean, we've been pretty successful with infectious disease in this country. So we have other issues that we need to focus on. But I mean, I guess one of the things that might help frame this conversation and sort of bring into context what public health folks really do focus on is when we think about health, what we think about. Because most people, I think, when they think about health, when you say public health, or you know, even when I describe what I do to people, they'll jump to the healthcare system and they'll be like, oh yeah, you know, screening from your doctor. And that's not what we do at all, actually.
Because we think about illness. When we think about health, we think about diagnoses and medicine.
Yeah. And so there's actually a spectrum of health. There's everything that goes into determining your health. And then there's once you get sick, how you're treated for that illness. And that's what we think about in this country when we think about health.
Because you don't think about health when you're healthy.
Yeah.
It's like one of those things where you don't realize what you have until you don't have it anymore. Yeah. So we're often thinking just about what it means to be sick. That's true.
And actually, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, it's one of the reasons why I feel really motivated in the work that I do, because when you aren't healthy, you realize how important your health is. And there are some people that are just like that all the time.
Oh my gosh. Like imagine forget about, like you said, people who are struggling with cancer, people are struggling with terminal illnesses or even just chronic illnesses that are just really debilitating. Just think about what it was like the last time you had a really fucking bad cold.
Yeah.
Or like the last time you sprained your ankle. Yeah. And you're like, oh my God, I can't remember what it was like to be able to breathe through my nose. I'm miserable. You don't think about how everything is working right now. I feel pretty good. I'm tired. I've been working a little too hard. I've been flying too much on airplanes. I've been getting these weird migraine things that have been happening lately, which sucks. I know I'm like starting, got to talk to a neurologist about these like weird visual migraines I've been getting. But outside of that, I'm healthy and I feel good. And yeah, you get like a cold. You get a little bit of a fever or just you can't breathe through your nose or your throat is scratchy and you're like, oh, fucking yeah, this is what it's like.
Yeah. And it affects everything else in your life. It sort of takes precedence over everything else. So it's like kind of a very basic component of what we consider leading a good life, like quality of life, like health is really at the base of the pyramid. But because most of the decisions being made are being made by people who are healthy, they don't think about it.
That's so true.
Really funny.
Because it's. You're so right. It's one of those things where we talk about perspective a lot when we're talking about maybe feeding the hungry or we're talking about, you know, big social systems and like, yeah, it's the rich who are in charge and it's the rich who are making the decisions. And that's really problematic. But by definition, sick people are not in a position to be making the kinds of decisions that need to be made to ensure that sick people are cared for and that they have the resources available to them that they need. Because by definition, when you're sick, you can't work.
Yeah, absolutely. And some places so will fire you for that.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Which is a huge bummer.
Yeah, it really is. So I'm actually looking up the World Health Organization definition for health.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny. It's such a broad word that you almost take for granted what it actually means.
So I want to quote it exactly, and maybe I'll remember it actually, but I want to quote it exactly because it's a wonderful definition. But basically, I'm not finding it right now, so I'll just say it.
We can try and find it. No. Everybody, while we're stalling, coming up soon, think about how you would define health, because I do think that's a really interesting question. So World Health Organization definition. We're working together, one on an iPhone, one on a laptop of health. I just moved a lot of space on my laptop, so it actually works now.
Okay, I've got it.
Oh, cool. Woo, is that it?
Same time. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
So
great.
The definition is a complete state of physical, mental, and social well-being, and not merely the absence of disease or infirmity. And that is actually, we lead with that. When we talk in our work, lead with that because people don't think about it. And I think it's a really powerful definition, actually, because it really goes to show that we're really looking at preventing, not only preventing disease, but really promoting good health and thinking about, you know, everything from the air we breathe to, you know, how we feel about our neighbors. You know, that's not something that we talk about a lot, but if you live in a neighborhood with really high crime, for example, you know, that's going to affect how you go outside. Even if the crime is actually low, but you perceive it to be high, then you're not going to go walk around or run in your neighborhood. You're not going to feel comfortable doing certain things that, you know, you would want to feel comfortable doing ideally.
And it also probably does have lasting effects on your psychological health too, because it's not just about not being able to get fresh air or take your dog on a walk or go on a run and do things that promote physical health, but it's about feeling trapped or feeling anxious or, you know, these like low levels of anxiety, which really can have like lasting chronic effects. It's an interesting definition. I'm sitting here looking at it because I think of myself as a relatively healthy person. I'm like, okay, mental and social well-being. Okay, I'm working a lot lately, which is great. I have a really great group of friends. Thank God. I didn't think Jeebus. I didn't when I first moved to LA, but I found some wonderful people here. Mental health, you know, I've struggled with that my whole life, but I take meds and I have a wonderful therapist that I see weekly. And I think that I'm kind of working towards at least maintaining that. Okay, not merely the absence of disease or infirmary. I don't, or infirmity. I don't really have, you know, any diseases right now. But there are also things that we don't think about. Like, I'm not really as active lately as I should be because I'm working so much. And my stress level is a little bit higher than I'd like it to be. And I'm drinking way too much Coca-Cola. I always talk about this. I'm drinking, just the sugar consumption is like not good. And so all of those things are components that lead to healthy living. You know, yeah. Some of them you can feel in the moment. Some of them you can't feel for like 10 years. You do the same thing every day. And then 10 years later, you start to really feel it.
Yeah.
But all of those things really do kind of combine to make either, I guess, an environment in which health can thrive or an environment where it's very difficult to maintain a healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. And I think that, maybe let me bring it to urban planning a little bit so sure. we can talk about
and
that.
And is that what you do now? Is yeah. you work in the urban planning component?
I like completely skipped over a chunk of my life.
That's okay. Yeah. People are following. You're following,
yeah,
right?
So basically I went to Boston for school and now I work there. Yay. Okay. So we're up to date.
So wait, what did you study in Boston, by the way?
I did my master's in public health.
In public health.
Yeah.
And then do they have focus areas? Like, or do you just get a generalized public health education and then you specialize after the fact?
So I went to the Harvard School of Public Health, and there they actually have specific areas that you focus in while mm-hmm. you're there, but that depends on the school a little bit. So okay. Halfway through my degree, they sort of like made the degree that I had consistent with other degrees, which is social and behavioral sciences, which sounds so much like cognitive science, yeah. but for public health.
Nice. So you actually went in to sort of study human behavior and its relationship to public health. Human emotion, human behavior, but then you ended up doing something that we think of as more like an engineering background almost, right? Like city planning, making decisions about how to structure the civic side of things to make people or to encourage better public health.
Yeah. So it's actually interesting that you say that because it's a nudge. It's a way to get people so in public health, we say this all the time. We say this to death all the time, which is make the default behavior the easy or the good behavior. So whatever you want people to do, you want to make that easy for them to do, right?
It's like an iPhone. It's like, yeah. That's what Steve Jobs was so brilliant about, right? It's the reason that iPhones took off so much and everybody has an iPod because it's intuitive. So if you can figure out a way to plan somebody's life so that the things they want to do intuitively are the healthier things and not the less healthy things.
Or they don't even think about health at all when they're making decisions.
Yeah.
So like, for example, if you have a beautiful street and there's slow car traffic or there's one lane or something like that and there's lots of trees or, you know, just imagine a street that you really want to walk down, like some place that you make an excuse to go to. Mm-hmm. If streets looked like that, people would just walk automatically more. I mean, there's a lot of other issues at stake there. My colleagues are probably like nodding their heads.
They're
no.
like, you're kind
they're
of
like, no, no, there's other things that matter. Yes,
no, but
there
it's
are.
True. I will go jogging. So I live, like we talked about, on the dividing line between Hancock Park and Hollywood. And if you've ever lived in SoCal, you probably know what that means. But if you haven't, you don't. Hancock Park is old. It's beautiful. It's a historic preservation overlay zone. It's big, rich houses with like beautiful lawns and big mature trees. And Hollywood is not. Hollywood is definitely, there's more homelessness, there's more poverty, there's more human trafficking, which is something I'm talking about recently on another show. And it's more visible. Yeah, it's not as tucked away. So when I go on jogs, of course I choose to jog through the rich, pretty, well-manicured neighborhood because it's calming to me. And when I... If I were to try and jog in Hollywood, which I've done a couple of times, but I always end up not doing it, it can be kind of stressful because I'm jogging through tent cities and I'm it's depressing and it brings me to a headspace that I don't want to be in when I'm trying to clear my head and feel better.
Yeah.
And so I actually make – it's funny because I live in a fork in the road where I can literally make the choice between jogging in a neighborhood that is – I think conducive to feeling healthy and a neighborhood that is not.
Yeah.
And I obviously choose the healthier path. Not because there's all sorts of like thoughts behind it, but because I'm like, that sounds nice.
Yeah.
No, let's go the way that sounds nice.
That's exactly it. Right. Yeah. And so the idea is, you know, well, how here, for example, okay, so Pavilions, where we met, is behind a huge parking lot. So there's this huge parking lot. I mean, it's very obviously designed for cars, right? Like you have Vine and then you have Melrose, which are very heavily traffic streets, each of which has at least four lanes of fast moving traffic and barely any crosswalks for pedestrians. Really, their only only at the intersections. And even there, it always feels a little bit like you could get run over by someone turning right who's not paying attention.
I walked to Subway the other day and a guy almost got run over by a woman turning left through the, and he was literally like, what the fuck? Pay attention. It was like, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean,
and
LA.
We had a walk signal.
Yeah. No, I actually got hit by a car when I was in college. A woman who was turning right.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. I was and so just frazzled. Didn't look. She didn't look. And it was a green light for pedestrians. And I was crossing in the crosswalk in Westwood, which is a very pedestrian zone, too. And I got hit by this car. Yeah. And, it's really interesting, right? Like, how people behave is entirely dictated, or is in very large part dictated by their environment. And obviously, we all are individuals. We make individual choices, but we have a spectrum of choices that we make. And you can even think about it when you travel. Like, if you go to Europe, Europe is designed for walking. Europe is designed for walking. It's designed for biking. And so you go there and you walk everywhere and it's awesome. You know, it's beautiful and you love it. And you come to LA and you drive because LA is designed for driving.
It's definitely not designed for walking. No. Like, they're trying to work on it, but you're right. It's you drive to a place to walk. Like, when I hike in LA, I drive to the place where I then get out of my car. I find parking, which is really frustrating. Like, if I'm going to go to Runyon or Griffith, you have to drive around forever to find a parking space to then go on a hike.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
And you're so right. You think about the way that the cities are planned to encourage behavior. We're just talking about this on Skeptic's Guide. We got a lot of feedback too from people in London. So I apologize if you guys are listening. Don't be mad at me. But we were talking about how, like, driving on the wrong side of the road is really confusing to most people in the world who don't drive on that side of the road. There's like 5 or 6 countries that do it, but it's definitely the vast minority. And when you go to England, it's such a melting pot and it's such a heavily visited place, right? Because in Europe, it's much easier to visit other countries, that it says at every single crosswalk, look right.
Yeah.
Because if you don't think to,
you're
like, the cars are coming from the wrong side. Yeah. You'll get hit.
Yeah.
And so they actually have to print that on the road.
I almost got hit by a bus the last time I was there. And I know to look right. You know, it's just not, sometimes it's not the instincts that you have.
You're like, I'm the person that tells them to put that on the street.
Yeah. I'm the person who tells them to redesign the streets so that there's no way that pedestrians can get hit.
But smart. You're the person who's like, how about we just drive on the right side?
For the record, that's not what I said. Yeah, I did not say that.
I totally put those words in her mouth. I will take full responsibility. So what are some of the projects? Like, I'm interested to hear, okay, first of all, what is your official title?
So I'm a public health planner and research analyst.
Planner and research analyst. Okay.
Really, so just public health planner, which is actually not a thing, by the way. It's a new thing. We're making it a thing.
I love that. Yeah. You're like, this is what I do. This is what my title should say. And so you work for the state of Massachusetts or for the city of Boston?
So the state of Massachusetts, we're regional. So Massachusetts doesn't have counties. So we're the pseudo county level organization.
Is that because Massachusetts is so small?
No.
I don't understand the East Coast, by the way. I'm from Texas, a vast land where you can drive for 18 hours and still be in the same state.
You really can.
It's crazy. And so when I visit the Skeptic's Guide guys, I just did to watch Star Wars, they live in Connecticut. They all live in different towns, but they're pretty close to each other. And it just blows my mind that I could fly into New York City and then just like be in Connecticut like a half hour
later. Yeah.
It's just crazy to me that everything is very close. So Massachusetts, I visited many times for work. I usually just fly into Boston and either go to Boston or to Cambridge and then leave.
Yep.
So is it small enough that all of Massachusetts is kind of a county?
No, actually, there's multiple counties in Massachusetts. So they're divided in a lot of different ways.
Gotcha.
We just don't have county level government. So that's the distinction.
So you have counties, but you don't have individual governments like LA County does.
Exactly.
Gotcha. Okay.
And that's a state level thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not sure what the history of that is, but we don't have county level government. So we have a state department of public health, and then we have departments of public health, like the Boston Public Health Commission would be the public health organization for the city of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And the Cambridge Health Alliance is the one for Cambridge. And then we have nothing in between. And so we've sort of become, we partner a lot with the Department of Public Health, actually, and we've become sort of a county level entity that can sort of work on multiple municipal scales.
I see. So you've become like the de facto sort of public health department because there is no jurisdiction in certain areas. So you're specifically, I had it pulled up here before. What was it called? It was a long acronym. And I was like, what is that? Metropolitan Area Planning Council. So that's this chunk of the state.
Yeah.
The so, part in blue.
Yeah. If you go if you go to MAPC.org, you'll see the diagram that appears on all of our documents as well. But we actually, so we have 101 cities and towns, and it's actually half the state's population. So we have 3.5 million people in
because
our
you're in
region.
The more metropolitan area.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yeah,
cool.
Exactly. And so you, I forget what your original question was. Actually.
I don't know.
Was it just what we do?
I forgot. Yeah. So, because you were saying, well, I'm the person that helps to design the street. So first you gave me your title, which was that you are a public health planner.
Yep.
And also you do research, which you would need to do to plan. Makes sense. And so what does that do?
Yeah. So it's not, like I said, it's not a defined thing right now, actually. So we're sort of figuring that out, which is why I end up talking to people about what this is all
How
the time.
Fun, by the way, to be like, I'm figuring out what my job is as I go, but I'm really important.
Yeah.
So I work there.
So it, again, not my words. No, I'm just kidding. So I don't want to take all the credit here. I mean, we're a team of people. There are three of us. And my colleagues, Barry and Lola, and I are actually the public health team at the Metropolitan Area Planning Council. And we do basically, we're really opportunistic because we, you know, there's no established way of being a public health planner. And so we're really trying to find opportunities for that. And in part, we have to find funding. So even though I work technically for the state, but we're governed by a council of people that's elected from our 101 cities and towns, because we don't represent the whole state. We represent technically 101 cities and towns in Massachusetts.
So that becomes kind of your, I don't know, constituency. It becomes the people who you're there to serve.
Yes. And so because of that, we're an independent state agency, which means we can apply for funding. So we actually apply for a lot of external funding, and we have all kinds of different funders, and which allows us to do things like have a public health division, which other regional planning agencies or MPOs, I forget what they're called in California. There's another name for them in California. Anyway.
No idea.
And the regional planners, or the other regional planners are not necessarily as able to do, even in Massachusetts, actually. And so what we do is anything from work on tobacco-free housing to try to actually, we do a lot of research studies where, you know, there'll be a policy that's passing or there'll be some kind of, we would love to do a comprehensive plan. So like, you know, when a city decides to plan for the future, the next 10 years, do a master plan or something like that, we would love to be involved in that because you can sort of talk about all the different components of planning, which include like how you're going to develop housing, you know, what the gaps are, what the city should be focusing on, transportation networks. Yeah. And we've talked about, you know, obviously the different ways you can get around, which are walking, biking, driving, skateboarding, you know, who knows?
Public transit?
Yeah, public transit.
Or like, I guess if there's, you know, a new region, like sometimes what happens in states is that they're like unincorporated areas that are just like county areas that don't really have their own technical city. So how cool would it be if like, if a new city was going to incorporate and they had to centralize everything and kind of start from scratch? Like we don't, you know, Massachusetts is obviously older, but there, we would see this happen in Texas where like a new town would spring up because it used to be pretty rural. And then they all realized, oh, we need a government and we need to actually function like a real city. And then it really is like kind of Wild West at the beginning, like start from the beginning and really plan instead of hodgepodging everything together.
That's cool. That's an interesting thing that I don't have experience with in Massachusetts. We definitely plan for, at least especially in our region, for existing towns.
For existing towns.
Yeah.
And then it's more that the town finally says, like, things aren't really working. We want a new plan for the next 10 years or the next 15 years.
So this is where some of my urban planning knowledge may not be totally exact because I'm trained as a public health planner and even though, or a public health person, not public health planner by practice.
Yeah.
But all my urban planning knowledge is on the job. So there are certain things that, you know, about the history of urban planning and those things, it's a very detailed field that I don't know as much about.
So much of it seems like is like nitty gritty when it comes down to like, I don't know, like understanding like the codes of the, like the legal mumbo jumbo and kind of the history of the town and can you do things this way? Is it legal to do things this way? And whose jurisdiction is it? It's so much more than just saying, wouldn't it be great if we had an initiative where people could X, Y, Z and then they'd be healthier? It's like you have to figure out how governmentally to be able to pull all this shit off.
Yeah.
And also how to finance pay for it.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's like the hardest part.
Yeah.
Right?
Usually one of the biggest barriers is how do you pay for it? You know, you might look at a street that has no sidewalks because there are streets that have no sidewalks or who have like, you know, terrible sidewalks or something like that.
And or that don't have like drainage.
Yeah. Oh, LA has a lot of that.
Yeah.
And you're like, has a lot of no drainage.
Not healthy. Like, look at all that standing water in the street. Like that's a, like a simple thing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Or like a street with a bunch of potholes that needs to be redone. I mean, that's really expensive.
Yeah.
And it, you know, there could be like if you build a park and let's say you have money to build a park, then you need to maintain it.
That's true.
And that's a whole other budget that people might not consider when they put something together originally. But to get back to your original question, I actually think in Massachusetts, plans are mandated.
Okay.
Yeah. So they have to do, the cities have to actually plan. Massachusetts is like, you know, you mentioned it's older. It's pretty
established.
Yeah. It's pretty good about certain things related to, you know, planning to the for the future. I mean, they're pretty active around climate change and trying to understand, you know, how the state itself should structure itself in order to be prepared for the next 20, 50 years. So it's actually actively thinking about stuff like that regularly. So it's a little bit different than other places in the country.
And didn't Massachusetts have kind of their own version of public health care before everybody else did?
Oh, you mean the
like Romney care?
Yeah, Romney care. Yeah. Yeah, no, they did. And the
so that shows that the almost like that the legislature there is a little bit more forward thinking when it comes to, you know, trying to have, I guess, maybe at least thoughtfully to be thoughtful about having an organized approach to maintaining the health of the population. Because like you were saying earlier, it's not just about what do you do when you're sick. But obviously, if you have a system in place for preventive care, that helps maintain a public where you don't have as many people falling through the cracks.
Yeah. I do want to emphasize that this is not legislated at all. Like we're sort of at the beginning of it's definitely becoming more of a movement in the planning field. Hopefully it's not some kind of phase where people are like talking about healthy community planning right now and then that falls
then it, like,
off
goes
in
out
5 years.
Out of vogue.
Yeah.
But do you think it will be legislated in the future? Do you think it will become so apparent to people when you look at, I don't know, like sometimes we see those polls, right? About where in the country are the happiest people, not in the country, but like where in the world are they? Oh, it's always like fucking in the Netherlands. And you're like, oh, they're so happy there. Or just, you know, quality of life issues. Where's the air the cleanest? Those kinds of things. And I think that that would be a big point of pride for certain communities or certain counties or even certain states where they're like, well, we need to keep being the best at this. We should legislate this. This should become a part of our core driving force. Do you think that we'll ever get to the point where it's centralized in that way?
I mean, I would hope so. I think that would be really interesting, although tricky, because, you know, you'd have to be thinking about it. It's sort of like it's what you're suggesting is actually kind of like the health in all policies, which is where public health wants to move. And it was actually the theme of this past year's conference was health in all policies. Which sounds a bit jargony, but it basically just means, you know, whenever you pass a policy, you're thinking about people's health when you pass that policy. And whenever you build a building, you're thinking about people's health when you build that building.
It's so funny that I feel like it's something that most people just take for granted. Like, obviously, somebody thinks about that when they build a building. And you're like, no, don't at all.
There's actually, architects will think a lot about indoor air quality. That's especially for larger buildings. That's definitely something people think about. People think about things like earthquake safety in California a lot. But, you know,
that's a component of health, not dying.
Yeah.
That's important for your health. But they don't think about things like internal green spaces and
or just the connection between places. There's no comprehensive approach is really what it is. Is that it's not consistently sort of something that people always integrate. So I think a lot of people will talk about public health now, like where environment was maybe 40 years ago.
Sure. Yeah. That it was like only hippies really gave a shit a long time ago. Yeah. And that now they, you're like, you know, a new, now you're every, like a health hippie.
Now everybody knows, you know, yeah. your air quality matters. Like you want to be breathing clean air. And that's like one of the examples I give. Yeah. but yeah, no. So when I talk about like why sidewalks are important, people don't totally understand that right away. And maybe in 40 years they will. That would be really nice.
It's so funny because it's definitely one of those things where it, I mean, you mentioned it before. It's so obvious that people don't think about it. It's like so duh. It's one of those huge hindsight moments. It will be one of those huge hindsight
moments. Hopefully. That would be so awesome. That would mean we being the collective, we have succeeded.
Because it seems like the biggest roadblock to the work that you do, and this is a big roadblock in a lot of areas when it comes to, I think, civil justice, mm-hmm. is... food justice, things like that, is poverty. That somehow these are the kinds of things that only rich people have access to. Oh, I'd love to have a nice interior botanical garden in my office building. Yeah, well, the projects aren't going to have that. Like, that's all gravy. That's all icing. And so how do you get to the point where it becomes, no, this is a core necessity. It's not just a nice little touch, you know, it's an aesthetic thing on top, like putting art in a hallway or something like that. But even something as simple as art, having art installations in neighborhoods that are often forgotten can really do a lot for public health. So how do you square that circle and kind of get past that big roadblock?
That is exactly one of the things we try to work on, actually. Mm. And, you know, it's a frustrating area to work in because trying to understand, you know, it's sort of like thinking about it a little bit like Maslow's hierarchy of needs. You know, mm-hmm. what are the first things that you need to focus on? And do you really want to start by focusing on just one thing? Like if there's a high crime neighborhood, do you just want to work on crime first, or do you also want to be working on parks at the same time? How do you distribute the different amount of effort that you put in each of those things? And honestly, how do you tackle crime? That is tricky. And,
yeah, I mean,
and how do you
tackle that? Takes decades.
Potentially.
And also those kinds of things are synergetic. Like we know that they're correlated. Like you can't just say, oh, we'll fix crime and then we'll think about putting in a nice park. It's like, no, if you have a nice park, then people, young kids have a place to go and things to do after school. Like all those things are correlated and that can actually be a driver of reducing crime.
Yeah, potentially. But it's so tricky to know when that actually happens. And there's actually a movement in urban planning right now to be more quantitative about some of those things and to try to actually measure what the thresholds are and to try to get an understanding of like, okay, what does this pivotal point seem to be for these different places? And how might you, what are successes? What are successful initiatives? And that was successives is a real word, and I combined
it
two
is.
Other real words.
Successives, yeah, I guess, yeah, is a
anyway,
real word.
Yeah.
I'm
successive.
Like, what does that mean? No, that obviously has a
successful
meaning.
Successful initiatives combined into one word.
Well, see, this is why it's important that you are in the position that you're in, because you are a skeptic. Like, I can tell you're a skeptic. You need data. You are not making decisions based on a gut feeling and saying, well, you know, if we had flowers there, it would be better. Like, we just need flowers. And it's like, does the data show that spending a fuckload of money on flowers is going to do anything? Maybe it's not the best place to put our money.
Yeah, you're totally getting at one of my, like, biggest gripes with this work, which is evaluation. There's never enough money for evaluation. So people don't evaluate their projects. And so one of the things that we are trying to do right now is actually be more active about that and try to understand, well, are we being successful? Like, what are the outcomes that we want? Let's establish those before we actually do anything. And, you know, you mentioned the real world. Mm-hmm. Kind of hate that distinction. I feel like everywhere is the real world. You know, it's just like the world is whatever it is.
It's
for you.
True. There is a weird academic bubble, though, that like protects people. It's like being in the real world with training wheels and a lot of like pads. Like you're wearing a lot of pads on your body. It's just a little bit of protection, I think.
Yeah, there's certain things, I guess, that you can get away with more there and you don't have to learn other kinds of things, maybe.
Oh, yeah. You don't. I have many friends who have no life skills.
Yeah.
Because they've just been in school their entire life.
So both of my parents are actually professors.
Nice. So they never grew up, is
what
you're saying.
Yeah,
I love
big
it.
Teenagers.
I love
Yeah. No, we grew up being able to, you know, take 3-month trips back. So they're European. So we would go to Europe over the summers, which I always thought was so weird in a way. When I was a kid, I was like, I'm so different than other people. But it's actually why I do the work I do now, because I grew up between LA and Europe. And, you know, that's a huge contrast in terms of the environment that you're in and then how you yourself behave when you're in those different places.
Surely your political values, your emotional value, like all of those things are very different depending on how much of the world you've seen and how many people who are in different situations than yourself you've been exposed to. So your name, just you were mentioning that you grew up back and forth between Europe. Your name is French. Are your parents French?
My dad.
Your dad's French.
So my dad's French and my mom's actually Dutch. Yay, oh, okay. The Netherlands. Happy people.
Nice.
Yeah, although she lives in LA now. So
very happy people. I am. One of my very good friends is half Dutch and she is quite happy. So your name, I need you to say it. So wait, I'm going to try.
Okay.
Noemi?
Yeah.
Sportiche.
Yeah, you got it. You
so that's
it.
Very French. But can you say it with a French accent?
Noemi Sportiche.
Oh, God. See, I could not pull that. That's beautiful. It's very different with my bullshit American accent.
No, I apparently made up that pronunciation when I was like 3. I corrected my parents and I was like, no, this is how you pronounce my name.
Oh, to Noemi?
Yeah.
Because how were they saying? Oh, because they were
saying
French.
They would say Noemi, yeah.
Yeah, Noemi. That clothes is terrible. I'm like, croissant. No, the only thing I know how to say in French is, oh, I learned this when I went to Paris 2 times ago. And it's going to be terrible. I apologize to anybody listening who actually speaks French. Je suis désolé, je ne comprends pas.
Oh, that was pretty good.
Really?
Yeah.
That's all I know how to say.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
But it gets me by when I'm in a restaurant. And then people don't get really mad because I'm like, I'm trying. Yeah. But I don't understand anything you're saying.
Yeah, no, actually, the French are like that, actually. If you can say... You know, if you can say something and show them that you're
trying
in their country and you're making an effort, then they're all like, okay, we speak English.
Yeah, like I'll be like, café crème. And then they'll be like, and then they'll say a bunch of stuff and then I'll be like, sugar. They're like, it's cool. I can totally speak English. Like, I tried.
Yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, so that really does affect your outcomes and your perspectives, being somebody who has travel to different places, being somebody who has seen systems that work and systems that don't work.
I'd say every system works and doesn't work.
Yeah, you know, that's
sort of depends.
True.
But I was actually thinking about it even more in like just the physical design of a place. You know, mm-hmm. when you're somewhere, you behave a particular way. And there was always something about that I noticed, but I had no idea what it was until actually I started public health school. And it was really on... It was my first day and we were talking about, you know, how we call it the built environment, the environment we build. It took me like a year to figure out that that's what that was, but the built environment.
it's like an intentional thing. It's like, as opposed to like a natural selection,
exactly.
It's an artificial selection.
Yeah. As opposed to the natural environment, it's the built environment. But so the built environment affects the way that you make decisions. And it's one of the ways that you can intervene as a public health professional, even though and Harvard does not tell you anything about how to actually do that.
Yeah. But it's so important, right? Because we think of ergonomics and we think of intuition and we think of that when it comes to like technology, right? Mm-hmm. Oh, and, you know, having a gadget that works really well. I don't want to have to read an instruction manual. I just want to know how to do it. I think a good example of what you're talking about, this built environment, is like an airport, right? You land and you just know how to get to baggage claim. You just know because it's like built to funnel you in a certain direction.
It is.
Like you don't get lost in an airport. You just kind of can be a lemming and like walk through and then you just end up by the cab stand somehow.
Yeah.
And that's obviously not a mistake. Like people worked really hard to build it that way and to sell you bullshit on the way out. And you know, it's like the exit through the
especially
gift shop
the
model.
New ones.
Totally.
Yeah, the new airports are horrible.
But that's
like
also
that.
A big difference between, I think, the European model and the American model. And not just Europe, Asia, any other place in the world really puts a lot of pride in their airports. It's the first place you see when you enter their country, mm-hmm. and it's like a big kind of symbol. And in America, we just don't think about that. They're all shit.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I've never really thought about airports. I have a friend who studies airlines, actually, but I've never really thought about airports.
Yeah, because it's not really so much to improve health outcomes. It's more to like actually improve traffic flow and sales, probably, in an airport. But it's still that thing where you can actually affect people's decision making.
Definitely.
Just by designing the shit around them to be really... intuitive.
Yeah, there's that. And there's also, you know, some airports are sort of kind of awesome, like you're saying, and I'm thinking about it as mm-hmm. you're saying that. And you kind of want to spend time there. And then there's other airports where you're like, this place is horrible. Yeah. And what is it about those places that are make them great and make you want to spend time there versus the places that don't make you feel that way?
Yeah. Is it the architecture? Is it the art? Is it the green space? Some airports I've been to are really good about having internal courtyards so that you're never going in or out of security. But you still get to go outside once you're in the secure side, which is so important when you're just sitting waiting for a flight. You know, you're going to be in a tin box in the air for hours and hours and hours. You also don't want to be sitting hunched up in the airport for hours and hours if you have a delayed flight. Just to be able to get fresh air can be such an important thing for the weary traveler. And what a hub for fucking spreading diseases. Yeah.
I was actually going to say that's the big place where I would actually think airports play a role in health is the spread of infectious disease. I mean, if there's some way that the world ends, it's probably going to be through airport infectious disease spreading.
For sure. Yeah. And like, just look at the difference. I'm going off on huge tangents now, but that's what happens when I start getting towards the end of the show. But just look at the difference between the most recent Ebola outbreak and the Ebola outbreak in the 80s. We are more globalized now. More people can afford to fly. And this was so much harder to contain because it spread way faster and way further than the early outbreaks ever did.
Yeah.
That were localized in villages where there just wasn't as much travel back and forth, and especially not in kind of international hubs. Like, that's when things get a little bit frightening, but that's the world we live in now.
Yeah, so Ebola is not even that infectious, actually.
It's not at all. I know. It's, we've talked a lot about Ebola on the show because it's, it's fascinating.
Yeah, it is.
The problem is that it's not that infectious. It's just very, what's the word? Virulent. Is it? It makes you very sick.
Yes, yes.
If you get it, it's very dangerous. It's not that easy to get, but if you get it, it's, there's like, not a good chance you'll die, but depending on where you live and what kinds of options you have available to you, you might die, which is really scary. I don't know if virulent is the right word there, though, either. But sorry, virology listeners. This was an especially nerdy episode. I think I dug it.
Oh, man, that makes me happy.
Yeah.
That is a huge compliment.
Yeah, we totally geeked out, and it was fun.
Yeah.
So before I go, because I kept you so long, and, you know, we podcasted at just that time of day where the sun sets. You know how it's like the sunset's really early, right? Because it's winter, except we're on the good side of it now. The days are getting longer. But when it's setting like at 4:30, 4:45, 5, I don't know exactly when, and you're like out in it, you feel like you feel the circadian shift. Like you feel like you just get tired like as the sun's setting. You're like, I can take a nap.
No, it's so true. Yeah, I feel like that's a constant winter feeling.
It is.
So
right?
And you wake up in the morning and you're like, I don't know what. I have to wake up. It's not 7.
I know.
That's not possible. It's not true.
Oh, girl, you'd be waking up at 7. I only do that when I have an early call.
I was trying to make myself sound good, actually. I know. I wake up at 8.
I was like, that shit sounds horrible.
I'm like such a rebel on the East Coast. You know, they all wear like suits and stuff, and I like wear loose pants and nice. I get in the office a little later.
Oh, yeah. I feel like there's a movement now, especially with the women, which I fully embrace and love, where we're trying to figure out how to make our pajamas look appropriate for public wear. I'm like, oh, that's like, I'm really into like joggers, which is this like style of pants that's kind of fitted. It's like elastic around the waist and around the ankles, and you can scrunch it up and it looks really cute with high heels.
Yeah,
and
I would really like joggers.
Yeah,
actually.
But it's full on just wearing pajamas in public. It's fucking best. Anyway, so I close every episode asking the same two questions. So now I have to ask you, and we'll start with the depressing one and then move on to the happy one. So the depressing one is, of course, when you think about the future, in whatever context makes sense to you, whether it's personal or global, what is the thing that, you know, most concerns you? What keeps you up the most at night? What are you the most worried about?
Oh, man, I'm a global thinker, so I feel like I get on tangents about a lot of different things. But I guess the thing that jumps first to my mind is really the increasing spread between the poor and the rich, or just everybody and the rich. Income inequality, you know, I think is a huge thing that jumps right into my mind. And I hope that we can be a society that sort of comes back together. There's a lot of benefits to that. And we didn't really talk a lot about that in the show, but that's really important for public health too, and just all kinds of things. And also for all of us who are, you know, not super rich and who are trying to just get by, and it just gets harder. So that's probably the thing I'm the most concerned about, I guess. There's a lot of things to be concerned about, though.
There really are. Yeah. But I think you really hit the nail on the head when you mentioned that. A lot of times people say climate change. A lot of times people say I don't know, like they talk about things that actually I think are fully affected by increasing income inequality. Like we talk about climate change, we talk about campaign finance reforms, elections being bought and sold, we talk about poverty, we talk about infectious disease. Like so much of this is tied to resources being sequestered with the 1%, with the smallest, most powerful faction of individuals having all of the wealth and all of the resources. It's so much of what you're talking about underlies these other problems that I feel like it's true. If you want to be kind of a reductionistic thinker, a scientific thinker, and think about what's the main thing that we can focus on because other things will actually benefit from affecting change there. I agree. I think it's this problem.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, I'm skeptical naturally of anybody who thinks that there's like one issue. Some people will sell you like, oh, sugar is the thing that you need to cut out of your diet.
You cut out sugar and you'll just live forever.
Yeah.
You just need to drink resveratrol.
No, we're all going to die. It's going to happen. True. Nothing will keep you young and immortal.
Yeah.
But you know, I think the same thing is true for the issues. You know, people will say that about gerrymandering and campaign finance reform. Mm-hmm. And I think those are huge issues. I agree. But narrowing it down to one issue, I'm skeptical of that idea in general. But yeah, income inequality is the first thing that jumps to my mind.
And I agree. Yeah. So many things are so intricately interwoven mm-hmm. and they're inextricable. You can't even pull them apart. But I definitely do see that oftentimes when I talk about big picture issues, whether they're scientific in nature, environmental in nature, or more civil rights, civil justice, kind of issues that even atheistic issues that I like to talk about on my show, so much of it comes down to this big rift, you know. It's not so much maybe that if we solve this problem, all of our problems would be solved, but I feel like this problem has so many tentacles that are wrapped around all of these other issues that it's very difficult to tease it away. And it really does have an effect on you know, so many chips that would fall ahead of it. But okay, depressing part out of the way, what are you most hopeful about? What do you look forward to the most and feel kind of confident that we as a people will be able to do better in the future?
Well, I think we're a society that's kind of obsessed with always thinking about what's going wrong, but we've made a lot of progress actually. And I guess, my mind jumps straight to health things, of course, mm-hmm. as usual, but I think a lot about medicine and just, you know, technology and medicine, those kinds of things are just, it's amazing to look at what's happening with that. I'm personally really excited about the microbiome, which is completely out of anything I do. Some people have done urban planning microbiome kind of stuff or biome stuff.
Weird.
Yeah,
that's
very
kind
cool.
of fun.
Yeah, super interesting. It's not like the actual gut, but it's like, you know, what bacteria are present. You probably read articles about this, what bacteria are present on a map in a different place, you know, in New York City, for example.
Oh God, I can only imagine. Like a subway map in New York City.
Yeah, you like, get fragments of like a really, really big thing. Like
I got MRSA in New York City.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's terrible.
I know. It's
I'm
disgusting.
Very sorry.
MRSA's gross, but
I
so
take
is
take it
New
you're
York.
Okay now, though.
I'm better. It okay. was 2.5 months of struggle, but it was a few years ago now.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. New York's fucking dirty.
Yeah, New York's really dirty. Yeah. And it used to be so much dirtier,
That's
too.
True.
So
yeah.
It's changed a lot.
And so, like, just what you're saying, it's we always focus on what's wrong and like, oh, everything's so shit. And it's like, no, we're living longer than we ever lived. We have better health outcomes than we ever had before. People with cancer are pushing through it better. People with full-blown AIDS are living full, like, complete lives. Like,
yeah.
It blows my mind, but we don't often stop and take stock of that. We're just like, we gotta make it so there's never cancer and it all goes away. And it's like, well, we've made some huge strides. Like, we should kind of stop and go like, oh, this is awesome.
Yeah, I think it's important to like recognize the progress that we make, but also be cognizant of the fact that there's more progress to make. And that's always going to be true. There's always better. We can always do better. But
some people aren't going to be, you know, like the futurists out there, the Kurzweilian like crazies out there won't be happy until we live for like 500 years. And
I read somewhere like maybe like 15 years ago. So it's definitely unreliable at this point that our potential was to live to like 800 years or something.
That's
ridiculous.
So crazy.
Like, I know, it's so ridiculous.
Can you imagine?
Yeah,
I don't think we're
life.
Psychologically equipped for that.
And I think we'd live exactly the same, but we would live like a third of that as like, you know, through our 30s, basically. You know,
here's hoping.
Like 300-year-old, 30-year-old person.
Yeah, that would be great. Because can you imagine if we just lived to be like 90 and then another like 700 years on top of that, but you were elderly during all those years.
Oh gosh, yeah, no, that would be awful.
Fuck that.
Yeah, that would be
not fun.
A whole different universe.
Yes, it would.
Yeah, no, so I think those are the things that I feel hopeful and excited about. You know, I'm excited to see what people come up with. There's always crazy new inventions coming out, and they're really interesting, and I think there's a lot of cool stuff that, you know, could come out that will change our world.
I completely
inevitably
agree.
We'll be brushing our teeth differently in 20 years. Who knows?
We already are, man. Yeah. We're all using Sonicare toothbrushes.
Oh, I'm using an old school one.
I do when I travel. But yeah, I mean, just little things like that you never thought about. Like there's like a thing in your fridge and just clean water comes out of it. And I'm like, what? Like there's so many things. You just flip a switch and then your house is illuminated. Yeah. Like those little changes that we take for granted are huge steps for productivity and for improved health. For sure.
Also just like quality of life. Like we live easy lives actually in a lot of ways.
Yeah, we do. And if you don't, if you question that at all and you want a moment of perspective, and I've mentioned this multiple times on the podcast, but I will continue to push this documentary. If you've never seen God Grew Tired of Us, which is about the Lost Boys of Sudan, please watch this documentary because it chronicles these boys after they basically left civil war in Sudan, ended up in a refugee camp in Kenya with no family, with no resources, and different governments basically adopted a big chunk of these boys, and a lot of them came to America. And this documentary chronicles a handful of boys that came to America and grew up to be men here. Some of them fell through the cracks. Some of them ended up being thriving diplomats and politicians. But there is just a really fantastic and emotional experience during the film where they see things for the first time that they've never been exposed to, like light switches, like gas ranges, like running water on tap that's just available at any moment. I mean, these are kids who grew up basically in like dirt huts, and it blows your mind. Like just watch it to get that kind of perspective that you forget about because you can take a hot bath anytime that you want to. And you'll cry and shit. I'm crying thinking about it. But it'll also really warm your heart and make you feel appreciative, I think, of everything that you have. And I think that you've done a good job today of helping me remember all of the things that I should appreciate too. So, Noemi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was a blast.
It was really fun. It was really serendipitous meeting at the grocery store. And now we're friends. Yep. I love it. And everybody, thanks for coming back after this short hiatus for the holidays. Thank you for coming back as often as you do week after week. And I'm looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.